Well, last week we were looking at his needs, her needs, and we looked at the first two of the needs of wives, and that was affection and communication. And today I want to finish up the wife's needs, looking at the last three remaining of those, and that would be honesty and openness, financial support, and family commitment. And then next time, Lord willing, we will get into the men's needs, the husband's needs, and probably spend two Sundays on those as well. So the guys are going to be off the hook after this sermon, and then the women are going to be on the hook in the next sermon, so the next two. So we'll look at honesty and openness first of all. So it's, of course, an important thing in our Christian lives to be honest in general, right? This isn't something that is only unique to marriage. Like, you can be a liar in the rest of your life, but you need to, you know, tell the truth to your wife. That's, of course, not the truth. If you look in Ephesians 5:25, this is something that we all ought to be doing all the time. Ephesians 4:25 says, "Wherefore, putting away lying, let every man speak truth with his neighbor, for we are members one of another." There's one house in this country where there's a lot of lying told, and a couple of houses, the White House and the House of Congress, right? Lies are told there all the time, but it shouldn't be happening in our own houses, that's for sure. And if there's ever a time or a person that you should be honest with, it is your own spouse. That's extremely important, as we'll look at here as we go through this. So in order to be honest, the best way to do that is to start with yourself. Start being honest with yourself and telling yourself the truth about yourself. Because a lot of us don't like to face the truth about ourselves. We like to be in denial about what we really are. But we're told in Psalm 15 in verse 2 that a good man not only speaks the truth outwardly, but he speaks the truth in his heart as well. In Psalm 15 and verse 2, Psalm 15, verse 2, we are, as human beings, we're interesting creatures, and we have the ability to lie to ourselves and even to deceive ourselves and to make ourselves believe things that aren't even true about ourselves or others. And I'll get into a couple of verses here in a second that we are exhorted not to deceive our own selves, to tell lies to ourselves about ourselves. But Psalm 15 and verse 2, I'll start with verse 1. It says, "Lord, who shall abide in thy tabernacle? Who shall dwell in thy holy hill?" So who is it that's going to be in heaven, right? Who's going to be in God's church down here, and who's going to be in heaven above? "He that that walketh uprightly and worketh righteousness and speaketh the truth in his heart." See, he's doing this inwardly. He's speaking the truth not only to people out there, but inside. He is living out his faith, telling himself the truth. And if you live the truth inside, it's going to come out. And we'll look at that in a second. But I just want to give you a couple of verses here, how the Bible exhorts us to not deceive ourselves. I was thinking about this when I was going through the outline, and these verses were resonating in my mind. And I went to look for them, because I knew that there was lots of verses in the Bible that tell us not to be deceived. But then I knew there was a couple that said not to deceive yourselves. And there are indeed are. If you look in 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 18, 1 Corinthians 3, 18. And then as I got looking into this, I started, didn't really start, but I created an outline with the title of deception, because I thought, you know, the Bible has a lot to say about deception, self-deception, and being deceived by others. And so, Lord willing, one of these days you'll hear that one too. Anyway, 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 18, Paul says, "Let no man deceive himself." You think, how can you deceive yourself? You know the truth, but you can actually tell yourself a lie long enough that you make yourself believe the lie. "Let no man deceive himself. If any man among you seemeth to be wise in this world, let him become a fool that he may be wise." So chances are, given that foolishness is bound in our hearts and we're foolish by nature, if we think that we are wise, we probably have deceived ourselves, and we're probably not wise if we think we are. If we think we are, then Paul says we should become a fool in order to become wise. So if you haven't yet become a fool, then you haven't become wise. All right, so if you are of a mind that I've always been wise, then you're definitely not wise, because that's certainly not true. You have deceived yourself. Now let's look at another one, Galatians 6 and verse 3. Galatians 6 and verse 3. says, if a man think himself to be something, when he is nothing, he deceiveth himself. I remember seeing this girl walking down the parking lot one time in Walmart, and her shirt said something like, I'm really a big deal, or something like that. And I just thought, no, I don't think so. I don't think so, not by the appearance anyway. But anyway, that woman right there had deceived herself, thinking that she's something when she is nothing. So it's good to start off with ourselves. Be honest with yourself. Know what you are. There's an old saying, I don't know who said it, but it is, know thyself. Good motto to live by, know thyself. The wise man teacheth his mouth, we're told in Proverbs. So teach yourself. Learn about yourself and then teach yourself to be a better person. That's what we all should do. So if we start speaking the truth in our hearts, then it's going to come out of our mouths. Luke 6 and verse 45. Luke 6 and verse 45. And you know, on that idea, that's why we should pray that the Lord would reveal things about ourselves to us. Because if you're the whole nature of deception is that you don't know you're deceived. You know, you have told yourself something for so long that you actually begin to believe it, and then you don't realize at that point that you're deceived. You really believe something about yourself that's not even true, right? Or you believe something about life or other people or whatever. It's easy to happen, and that's why we should pray, as we're shown in the Psalms numerous times, that the Lord would search our hearts, know our ways, see if there's any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. So pray to be delivered from things that we don't even know about, secret sins that we're not even aware of. Anyway, Luke 6 and verse 45, Jesus said, a good man out of the good treasure of his heart bringeth forth that which is good, and an evil man out of the evil treasure of his heart bringeth forth that which is evil, for of the abundance of the heart his mouth speaketh. So you can generally tell what's going on inside somebody from what comes out of their mouth, right? Pay more attention to what they do than what they say, but pay attention to what they say too. And pay attention to everything they say, I guess, because they'll say certain things which will try to make you think that they're something they're not, but they will say certain other things if you pay close attention, where you can start to pick up on little hints. And you can find out a lot about somebody if you just really pay attention to what they say. I'm not saying to evil surmise or to scrutinize everybody, but just when somebody says something, you're like, that didn't sound right. You just might want to pay attention and just think about that because, you know, they might have just tipped you off to something, especially to identify a liar. And I'll talk about this in a second. It's sometimes liars can get away with lying for a long time. You don't figure it out. You don't know. But then they'll say something, and then something, you'll remember something else they said, and then you'll be like, wait a minute, something doesn't add up here. And I'm able to spot a liar pretty well because I have arithmetic skills, and I'm kind of getting ahead of myself. But I can add. And when people are telling me things, I like to, I know I'm getting ahead of myself, but I may as well just say it now because it's on my mind. So I like to, when I get to know somebody, I like to learn about them, and I like to kind of know what their history was. And like, just interesting, like, when did you graduate from high school? Did you go to school? Did you go to college? Where did you work? What did you do? Just like, because that's how you really get to know somebody, when you kind of, if you didn't know them their whole lives, then you can get to know their history. And so that's like, and I work with numbers, so whenever I'm talking to people, sometimes I ask, well, how long ago was that? What year was that? Because I like to get kind of a timeline so I can understand better. And that has enabled me to find liars in my life. I had a guy one time, this was in the Army. You want to find some liars, go join the Army. You know what I'm talking about. Oh, okay. See, I had a cousin that went to VMI, Virginia Military Institute. He was 2 years ahead of me, so he went there right out of high school. And it's like, it's akin to West Point. It's one of the most prestigious military academies in the world. And they have this honor code at VMI. And supposedly the strictest honor code in the world, right? And you don't lie at all. And if you do something wrong, you turn yourself in at that place. And my cousin said, for instance, there was a $5 bill laying on the bathroom floor in one of the latrines for like a week, and nobody touched it. Right? You'd be walking down the sidewalk, and you'd see things laying, you'd see money or coins or things laying on the sidewalk, and it never got picked up. Nobody would touch it. You didn't take something that wasn't yours. So he told me about all these things. And so I'm getting ready to join the Army, and I'm thinking, oh, that's what the Army's like. So I joined the Army thinking, like, wow, there's an honor code here or whatever. People are honest. I have never met so many liars in all my life. I went to basic training. Oh my goodness, there are so people are, and maybe it's because they're 18-year-old kids and nobody knows them there, so then they can tell all these stories because nobody can know that they're not telling the truth. But liars and thieves, that were probably the two most common people I met when I was in the military, and adulterers for that matter. Liars and thieves and adulterers. Wow, it's horrible. But anyway, where was I going with that? Oh yeah, so I had this platoon sergeant. I'm going to get back to the sermon here in just a second. I had this platoon sergeant, and I figured out this guy was a liar, because he would, like I said, I just pay attention, and he told me he'd been in the Army X amount of years, and then I asked him another time, you know, how old are you? And I find out how old he is, and I know how many years he's been in the Army, and he's been in this conflict or that conflict, and this and that. And then one day we're working on a truck, and he says, oh, I have a degree in metallurgy. Oh, really? Yeah. Where'd you go? Oh, I went to Penn State, da-da-da. And I'm just putting all this in my mind, and I'm thinking, no, you don't. You are a liar, because I know the dates that you've told me. I know how old you are. I know you were here and here and from this time to this time. And I figured out real quickly, this guy's a liar. And once I found out he was a liar, then I don't trust anything he says again. And I already knew he was a scoundrel anyway, and an adulterer and a bunch of other things. But anyway, once I figured that out, then I didn't have to go on any more fact-finding missions. But anyway, so if you just do a little bit of math, you can usually pick out a liar pretty easily. Anyway, let's get back to the sermon here. So this is really important in marriage, because a wife's sense of security depends on honesty and openness of her husband. I'm going to give you a quote here from Harley in his book, His Needs, Her Needs. He says, "A sense of security is the bright golden thread woven through all of a woman's five basic needs. If a husband does not keep up honest and open communication with his wife, he undermines her trust and eventually destroys her security. To feel secure, a wife must trust her husband to give her accurate information about his past, the present, and the future. What has he done? What is he thinking or doing right now? What plans does he have? If she can't trust the signals he sends, or if in the case of Frank, he refuses to send any signals," Frank was an example that he was talking about in the book, "she has no foundation on which to build a solid relationship. Instead of growing up with him, she grows away from him." And I thought this was a good observation, that women thrive on security. They like to be secure. They like to have a safe home. They like to have financial security. They like to know that their husband loves them and feel like that they don't have anything to worry about. That's a human need, but it's especially a woman's need. So I think Harley's absolutely right. And if you think about it, can you feel secure about somebody you don't trust? If you don't think somebody's telling you the truth, if you even doubt that they're telling you the truth, and maybe you don't know they're a liar for sure, and you can't prove it, but you just, for some reason, you have a doubt about this person, you can't feel secure with somebody like that. Would I have felt secure with that platoon sergeant in the Army, that I could trust him, that he would go to bat for me, that he would, who knows? No, I wouldn't trust that guy as far as I could throw him. So that's really important for a wife, for her husband to be absolutely and totally honest and open with her, because then she can fully trust him. And the truth hurts sometimes, and it might not make her happy whenever he tells her the truth, but it'll at least make her feel secure, right? And that's really important. So you don't want to let your, you don't want to tell your spouse, don't just tell your spouse what you think they want to hear for fear of hurting their feelings. Because I think we've probably all been guilty of this, where whether it's your spouse or it's somebody else, you tell them what you think they want to hear because you just can't bear to tell them the truth. Because if you tell them the truth, it's going to hurt their feelings. So you either just skate around the issue and you don't talk about it, or else you tell a lie and you tell them something that's not really true because you don't want to hurt their feelings. But that is not a loving way to act. It's an easy way to act, but it's not a loving way to act. Look at Leviticus 19 and verse 17. Leviticus 19, 17. Here's a maxim for you in life. Usually the right thing to do is the hard thing to do. The easy thing to do is usually the wrong thing to do. That's normally the case. Look at Leviticus 19 and verse 17. It says, "Thou shalt not hate thy brother in thine heart. Thou shalt in any wise rebuke thy neighbor and not suffer sin upon him." See, God's telling us here that if we allow our neighbor to sin, allow our neighbor to continue on a path that's not right, and we don't speak up and say something to him and rebuke him, we hate him. in our minds, we think, oh, I just love him too much to hurt his feelings, right? That's not true. You don't love him. Just like parents that say, I love my child too much to spank them. No, the Bible says you hate them too much to spank them, because if you loved them, you would spank them. He that loveth his son chasteneth him betimes. He that spareth his rod hateth his son, we're told. It's the same way with in husband-wife relationships. Tell your spouse the truth. Tell your spouse the truth about yourself, even if it's hurt, even if it hurts you to tell them the truth about yourself, and tell your spouse the truth about them. That's really important to do. That's the loving thing to do. Look at Proverbs 27, 5 through 6. Proverbs 27, 5 through 6. And then, when you're on the receiving end of it, accept the truth about yourself. When your spouse tells you the truth about yourself, accept it. Don't get mad at them for telling you that. And it's easy to do, right? We all get offended easily. When somebody tells us something about ourselves that we don't like, it's easy to get offended or to get our feelings hurt. But you know what? I'd rather get my feelings hurt, because I'll get over it, right? If I get my feelings hurt and I get mad, I'll get over it. Doesn't take very long. Usually a few minutes later and I'm over it. And you know what? Now I know the truth, and now there's something I can work on. I'd rather hear the truth, even though it does hurt. Look at Proverbs 27, 5 through 6. It says, open rebuke is better than secret love. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. So a friend is one that'll wound you, but not wound you to hurt you, wound you to help you. Right? Just think about, it's real easy, just think about the example of training your kids up and spanking them when they need it. Right? That hurts. It's painful. It's painful emotionally for you. It's painful physically for them. But it's necessary, and it's ultimately an act of love. And that's what a good friend will do. A good friend will tell you when you're wrong. Look at Psalm 141 and verse 5. But it's not easy to do. And I don't think it gets easier the older you get. I don't even think it really gets much easier the more experienced you get. Because I have had older, very experienced people call me up to rebuke me. And the person doing so, because they thought I was wrong, I was off base on something. And the person doing so is older, experienced, and everything. And I could still tell they were nervous. They're still nervous doing it, even though you've been doing it for years, right? And so it doesn't get easy. It's not like, oh, you know, I'm past all that nervousness when I have to correct somebody. It's never easy. It's easier the closer you are to somebody. But the less close you are to somebody, the harder it is. And I think the reason for that is, if it's your own spouse, you know they're not going to leave you. If you tell them something that's going to hurt their feelings, they're not going to leave you. At least they shouldn't. I mean, that shouldn't be a concern, right? If I have to tell my wife that she's wrong about something, or she tells me I'm wrong about something, there is no chance that we're splitting up over this, right? So I can tell her. But when I don't know somebody that well and I tell them the truth, they might split up with me, whatever the relationship is. They might not like me anymore, right? That's why it's harder to rebuke somebody that you're not as close to. Anyway, Psalm 141 and verse 5. Here's what David said, a man after God's own heart, remember. Let the righteous smite me. It shall be a kindness. And let him reprove me. It shall be an excellent oil which shall not break my head, for yet my prayer shall be in their calamity. David actually wanted a righteous man to correct him, right? When he's speaking of smiting there, he's speaking figuratively. He didn't want him to beat him over the head with a rock or something. But he wanted him to correct him, which is painful, like being smitten physically. But rather than it being something that would break his head, it would be like an excellent oil that would improve his health. And then what does he say? For then I will smite him back. That's not what he said. He said, for yet my prayer shall be in their calamity. He's going to pray for such a person like that whenever something bad happens to them. So when my wife, and I actually wrote this, like I said, I didn't change anything in the outline, so I actually wrote this before I was married, knowing that I preach it after I was married, so I wrote it and it's saying my wife when she wasn't actually my wife at the time. I said, when my wife asked me a difficult question, she always adds, honesty is the best policy. And that's what she used to do when we were dating. She'd ask me a question, and then she'd say, honesty is the best policy, because she wanted me, I think it was usually a question about her, like, what do you think about this? And she was afraid that, or she thought that maybe I would be afraid to say the truth because it hurt her feelings, and she'd say, honesty is the best policy. And she was right. Let me give you another quote here from Harley. This is page 92 of his book. He says, "Whenever and wherever your mate asks you how you feel, tell the truth. It is foolish to lie out of fear that you will hurt your spouse's feelings or possibly hurt your own pride. Your mate has the right to your innermost thoughts. Your mate should know you better than anyone else in this world, even your parents." So let me ask you a question, I guess. This would be a good question. Does your spouse, your husband or wife, do they know you better than your parents know you or older people knew you, if your parents aren't around anymore? Does your spouse know you better than your parents know or knew you? Just think about that. They should, right? They should. I'm certain that my wife knows me better than my parents do. Now, there might be things about me that, you know, my parents know that she doesn't know, that just because I've never told her, because I've forgotten, you know, funny things when I was a kid, and, you know, how I acted when I was three, which I don't even know how I acted when I was three, because I can't remember. I mean, things like that. But the innermost me, yeah, my wife knows the innermost me far better than my parents do. For one thing, I'm converted to the truth, and so is she. So we know each other on that level that my parents could never know me on, because they don't understand. Harley continues there. He says, "Knowing you includes your good and bad feelings, your frustrations, your problems and fears, anything that is on your mind. The Bible calls it two becoming one. We psychologists label it achieving good marital compatibility." I'm really glad that God wrote the Bible instead of a psychologist. Can you imagine if Jesus would have said, and the two shall achieve good marital compatibility? Right, when he said the two shall become one flesh or something. So, yeah. Psychologists stumble across the truth sometimes, and you can learn things from them. And if what they say is in accordance with the Bible, because all truth is God's truth, right? If they say something that is true, fine and dandy. But just watch them, because a lot of the stuff they say is not true. So you always want to compare everything anybody says by the Scripture. But anyway, this is what knowing you is about. Knowing your good and bad feelings, your frustrations, your problems, and your fears. Don't be afraid to tell your wife about your fears. Don't be afraid to tell your husband about your fears. We should be open and honest with each other. That's the only way we're ever really going to develop a close, tight-knit bond with each other, is if we're totally honest with each other. Now, I want to talk about the different types of lying husbands. So there's three different types, and I got these from Harley. I didn't come up with these on my own, but I think they're true. Three different types of lying husbands that women, especially if you're dating, you know, if anybody hearing this is dating, you want to watch out for these three types of guys, because you wouldn't want to marry somebody like this, especially the first one. The first one is the born liar. Okay? This is the husband who's always told, quote, little lies since he was a child, right? It seems like we think if they're little ones, it doesn't matter. Well, let me tell you what. James said, if you keep the whole law and you offend in one point, you're guilty of all. So even little lies in God's sight are big deals, right? Here's what Harley says, describing the born liar. He says, he fabricates stories about events in his past and constantly distorts the truth in subtle ways that seem almost unnoticeable at first. One can usually catch the born liar easily enough by doing a little simple checking. Like I said, usually a little simple math. That's the easiest way. Just when you talk to somebody and you start to wonder, I don't know about this guy, just start remembering things that he tells you, dates and things like that. And then you can pretty well, no, I'm not saying everybody messes up dates. And when you get older, the worse it is, right? Oh, that was like 2 years ago. It was like 20 years ago, right? I mean, that's really easy to do. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about my platoon sergeant whenever he clearly, you know how many years you were in the Army, right? Everybody knows when they joined and you know if you spent 4 years in college or not, right? This isn't like, oh yeah, I just kind of forgot it. I actually didn't go, you know? Right? I mean, there's a difference between that and, you know, I think it was a couple years ago and it was, you know, like 10 or 20. Anyway, where was I here? They're unnoticeable at first. One can usually catch the born liar easily enough by doing a little simple checking. But be warned, when confronted, he usually excuses himself by pleading a poor memory. A chronic liar finds it nearly impossible to consistently admit the truth about himself. And you've probably met people like this. You've probably met people that are what we would call compulsive liars. where they just lie all the time. And a lot of times, compulsive liars, it's weird. They lie about stuff that they don't have to lie about. They're not lying to get themselves out of trouble. You know, lots of people do that. But compulsive liars just lie for the sake of lying. I don't know exactly why they lie. I've never been able to get inside the head of somebody like that. But maybe they just like to tell stories that are interesting, so they just make them up, so they have something cool to talk about. I don't know. But people like this, it's probably virtually impossible to get them to stop lying, because it's just something that's inbred, whatever. It's part of them. It's just part of who they are. It probably started out as a kid. And this is one thing. Here's another thing. If you find your child lying, I would chasten that severely. Any lie for any reason, no matter how small, that deserves the rod. I would beat that lying out of them as soon as that starts, because I have known kids. I knew a kid that I went to school with. This kid was this born liar. I don't know if he still is or not. I've lost contact with him. But he would tell the most outlandish tales, and you couldn't believe anything he said. And he grew up in a nice family. I don't know what his deal was. But anyway, he needed to have that beat out of him whenever he was little. If you're dating someone like this, the born liar, dump him now. Get rid of this guy or girl. I don't know if, I think probably more likely to meet a guy like this than a girl, but I'm sure that there's plenty of lying women out there too, obviously. But yeah, get rid of them. Get rid of them right away. I'd say if you're dating someone, you catch them lying about something, I don't know. I mean, maybe you could rebuke them and maybe they would change, but I'd be really careful about that. Because marriage, what is marriage built on? Trust, right? I mean, what is the backbone of marriage? Trust. And if you find somebody that's lying to you before you get married, what do you think they're going to do after you get married? This type of liar needs rebuked sharply. Look at Titus 1, 12 through 13. That's why I said if it's your child, you make sure you take care of that right away. And here's the thing, and this is, I think I know parents that have done this, and I think this would be wise. I'm sure you probably have done it yourself. But you tell your child that if I find something and I suspect you've done it and I asked you, did you do this, and you tell me yes, you're still going to get in trouble. But if you lie to me, you're going to get in 10 times as much trouble. You may get a light spanking if I find out that you wrote on the wall. You lie to me about it, and you're not going to be able to sit down for a week, right? That's what I would recommend. Look at Titus 1, 12 through 13. Titus 1, 12 through 13. He says, one of themselves, he's talking about the Cretans here, this is funny. One of themselves, even a prophet of their own, said the Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, slow bellies. Now, Paul didn't say, well, he was kind of exaggerating a bit. You know, he really shouldn't talk like that about people. He says, this witness is true. They actually are always liars, evil beasts, and slow bellies. Wherefore, rebuke them sharply that they may be sound in the faith. So Titus, poor Titus, he is pastoring a church in a society full of people that are always liars, evil beasts, and slow bellies, because Paul left him in Crete, right? So there's Titus's church congregation. It's made up of people like that. And Paul says, this is true, rebuke them sharply. And these are what you call, I would say, compulsive liars. They are always liars. These people just lie constantly. They're just known for it. They can't tell the truth. They needed rebuked. Then there's the avoid trouble liar, right? And this one's really easy to imagine, because we've probably all been there at some point in our lives. We've certainly seen kids do this all the time when they lie to get out of trouble, and adults do the same thing. This is the husband who usually only lies to get himself out of trouble when he's done something wrong or forgot to do something that he was supposed to. I'll give you just a real simple example. Honey, did you call the plumber today to get the sink fixed? Oh, yeah, I did, but he never called. He left a message, never called back. But he forgot. He didn't actually call the plumber, right? That's the avoid trouble liar, right? Instead of just saying, no, I forgot, I'm sorry. And then your wife's going to be mad, she's going to be yapping, and you're going to have to hear it for a while, right? You just don't want to hear her yap, right? So you lie, right? That's what the avoid trouble liar husband does. But you shouldn't do that. I probably shouldn't have to tell you that you shouldn't do that, but you shouldn't do that. Tell the truth. take your beating, right? Do better next time. This type of dishonesty can be very destructive to a wife's trust and to the marriage. Because if somehow she finds out that you really didn't, maybe she just picks up your phone and looks at the call history and sees that liar didn't call the plumber. What's she going to feel? It was a minor thing. Who cares, right? You forgot. So what? She'd have been mad for 2 seconds. But now what's she going to think? I can't trust this man. I can't trust my own husband. He's a liar, right? You don't want to go there. This husband needs reminded that liars will have their part in the lake of fire. Remember that from Revelation 21 and verse 8? This is no trivial matter here. Revelation 21, 8, but the fearful and unbelieving and the abominable and murderers and whoremongers and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. And then we have the third type of liar, and this is the protector liar. This would be like the noble liar, right? He's not lying to get himself out of trouble, but he's lying to protect his wife. He doesn't want her to know things that would cause her to be worried or anxious or scared or something like that. So he will, quote, protect her by lying to her. This could be lying about the state of their finances so that she won't worry about it. This is probably the most likely protector lie here, lying about the state of the finances. When the husband really knows that our finances are in a mess and, you know, we're just ready to get the car repoed or something, or get, you know, the bank's going to foreclose on us, but he's telling his wife everything's fine because he doesn't want her to worry. He's going to protect her. That's a very, very bad idea. The problem with this type of lying, aside from it being sinful, of course, is that the wife doesn't know about the things that her husband's dealing with, and she will not understand when he's stressed out or irritable. So let's say your finances are a mess, but you don't want your wife to know about it. So you're telling her everything is fine or not telling her anything at all, and she's assuming it's fine. And meanwhile, you're stressed out. You're hoping, boy, I hope that that bill doesn't come due before my paycheck comes in or whatever. And you're stressed out and you're snippy with her. And then she wonders, what's going on? Why is he acting like this? Well, it's because, you know, he's about ready to have the bill man come and have the collection agency call up, and he's worried about it, but he doesn't want to tell you about it because he's afraid, he doesn't want you to be worried. And furthermore, here's what ultimately could have happened. If the problem which the lies were told to cover up continues to fester, then one day it all blows up, and then the wife's hit with an even bigger amount of stress without warning. So you can imagine with the financial example, if she doesn't know anything's going on, and then one day you wake up and you walk outside and the car's gone because it was repoed, well, then guess what? Right now, she's big time stressed out. Whereas if you'd have told her 6 months ago or a year ago that, hey, we've got to cut back this budget, we've got to get this thing under control, we got to do something because our finances are a wreck, then at least she could have dealt with it. But guess what? Now she has to deal with the calamity and the fact that you lied to her for all that time. Right? It would have been much better to tell her the truth. Beware of little white lies. Little white lies. In man's eyes, that is. They're not little white lies in God's eyes. Let me give you an example here. I used this example last time. I'm going to elaborate on it a little bit here. Telling your wife a little white lie concerning your thoughts on her weight gain, for instance, right? Now, I know some people say, oh, you should never talk to your wife about her weight, right? You should never tell her that she needs to lose weight. Why not? Why not? Let's say you had a husband and he only liked to shower once a week and he smelled like a pig, right? Would you say, oh, you should never talk to your husband about his hygiene habits? Why not? Tell him. Get a shower, you pig. You stink, right? Now, of course, men, with your wives, you want to be much more kind and compassionate and so on like that. But wives, I say your husband doesn't take a shower for a week. Yeah, you could use that exact language. I think you would be justified. But anyway, why not? It's not wise to tell your wife that her weight is okay with you when it's not. Right? If you know, some men don't care, but I would say deep down most men do. They may say they don't care, but I'll bet you they do. I'll bet you if they would be honest with you, they really do. But some men may not. But if you do care, and I'm not talking about a few pounds, but I'm talking about, like I said yesterday, if you married your wife and she was this big and now she's this big, right? That's not right. That is not right. you have expectations. And you know why it's not right? We're going to get to that in the next sermon, or maybe one after that, I don't remember, because one of men's needs are an attractive wife. That's a need that a man has, or most men, anyway. Now, of course, if you want to tell her about this, you want to tell her about it gently and kindly, and maybe offer to go on a diet with her or something. If your wife's having trouble keeping her weight down, or your husband's having trouble keeping his weight down, offer to go on a diet with them, right, and do it together. And then, I think it's a great idea, then you're in it together, right? You're in the trenches together, and it's a lot easier whenever you have a partner to do it. But if you did tell your wife that you're okay with her weight when you're really not, right, then here's what's going to happen. Then she's going to think that you don't care about it, and she's not going to try to lose the weight, or she might even gain some more, right? So, my husband doesn't care about it. Then, you know, who cares? That's not wise, right? Because if you really have a problem with it, but you said you don't, and then it continues, what's going to set in eventually? Bitterness and resentment. She looked really nice when I married her, and now she's gained 50 pounds or whatever, and you're just grumbling to yourself, and you're just mad, and you're upset, and all this stuff. Just tell her about it. Just tell her. Don't say, oh, honey, you look beautiful, and then in your mind say, oh, I can't believe she gained all this weight. Just tell her about it, right? Be honest with her. Be nice, but be honest. And the same thing goes with women. If your husband has turned into a slob, or if he isn't nice to you anymore, he doesn't do the things that he did whenever you were first married or something like that, and it bothers you, tell him about it. Be honest with him. So then what's going to happen? What's going to happen is one day when it's been bothering you for months or years, you finally make a cutting remark and her feelings are hurt, and then you lose major points in her love bank. That's what happened. You've been telling her for months or years, oh, no, you look wonderful. I don't care. It's fine. It's fine. And deep down, you've been upset about it. And then one day, you're like, you know what? Those pants look like, you know, they belong to our kid or something because you can't fit into them anymore. Or whatever. You make some really mean comment or something like that when you've been telling her, hey, everything's fine. Right? That's a bad idea. Really bad idea. It's much better to tell her the truth in a loving and compassionate way so that she knows how you feel, and then she can take steps to lose the weight. And here's what you never want to do. Never, never make sarcastic comments or tease your wife about her weight, especially in front of others. And even forget in front of others. Don't ever do it. Never make sarcastic comments or tease her about her weight. Or anything that have to do with her looks. Never, ever, ever do that, especially in front of other people. I have seen people do this, and I should have, and I did say something, but I should have just come out 2x4 across the eyes with this guy, and I didn't. I really should have. I should have tore a strip off of him. You want to remember, charity is kind. Look at 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 14. Verse 4, 1 Corinthians 13, 4. Charity suffereth long and is kind. Charity envieth not. Charity vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up. So remember, whenever you have, if you have to have that conversation with your wife, be kind about it, be gentle about it. Here's another quote from Harley. He says, but when a husband tells his wife the truth, he builds her emotional stability. By always being truthful, he tells her he knows she can handle it and can change when she must. The truth demolishes false impressions and illusions. Life becomes more predictable and rational because now she can understand her husband's behavior. The truth may be painful at times, and he should strive to deal gently with the truth. But the truth does not drive a woman crazy. On the contrary, a woman feels in control because now she knows what she needs to do to change the situation. A husband does his wife no favors when he tells her, quote, protective, unquote, lies to make her feel secure and loved. Eventually, exactly the opposite happens. A husband must present himself to his wife as he is. Then she can adjust, negotiate, and draw closer to him. So I think there's a lot of wisdom in what he just said there. Very important to be totally honest with her. And when you've put the truth out there And then you get past the initial reaction, the initial hurt or disappointment or whatever. Then it's out there, and then you can deal with it. And isn't it nice to be able to just talk freely with somebody about something? Maybe there's been something that's just you haven't brought up to somebody, and it's just been driving you crazy. And then you finally just bring it up and just get it out there. And then now it's not the elephant in the room anymore, right? Now we can just talk about it, and it's just it's not an area of contention any longer. So as my wife used to say, and probably still does, honesty is the best policy. Let's all practice being completely honest with our wives. Now this will take us to the next section here, financial support. I don't know, maybe I'll only get through two of these today. I'm not sure. It just depends. It seems like I take a lot longer to get through it than I thought I would. Financial support. This is the fourth need of a woman. You've always heard the old joke that women marry men for money. It's true. It is. And there's nothing wrong with that. It is true. Women marry men for money. Husbands are supposed to provide for the needs of their wives, which is why financial support is one of the primary needs of a wife. We're told in Ephesians 5, 28 through 29, that husbands are supposed to nourish their wives. Look at Ephesians 5, 28 and 29. Paul says, "So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth him, his wife loveth himself. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church." So it says here that a man, as he nourishes his own body, ought to nourish his wife. To nourish is to provide for the needs of his wife and her well-being. And I will give you the definition which will show this. To nourish is to sustain a person or living organism with food or proper nutriment, to supply a thing with whatsoever or with whatever is necessary to promote its growth or formation, or to maintain it in proper condition. So when it says husbands, nourish your wives, provide for their needs is what it's telling us here. This is the duty of a husband. A man has to provide financially for those of his own house, and if he doesn't, he's worse than an infidel. Look at 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8. You could have the Bible memorized from cover to cover, right? You could be the greatest Christian that ever lived. But if you're a bum and sit at home and don't provide for your wife, then guess what? You're worse than an infidel. But if any man provide not for his own, Paul says, and especially for those of his own household or his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. And I don't think Paul is exaggerating here or using hyperbole just to try to say, hey, well, you really need to provide for your wife. No, he's really saying you have denied the faith, because this is one of the fundamental tenets of the faith, is that husbands provide. Husbands ought to provide. So it follows that if the scripture says that wives are supposed to be keepers at home, and we looked at that verse here, we looked at it last time, I don't remember, Titus 2 and verse 5. So we can kind of deduce this. So I go at it from a couple different angles. The Bible says it, and then we'll also deduce it from other things. Titus 2 and verse 5, this is the age of women are supposed to teach the younger women to be discreet, chaste, keepers at home, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God be not blasphemed. So the Bible teaches women are to be keepers at home, and women are to guide the house. 1 Timothy 5:14, I will therefore the younger women marry, bear children, guide the house, give none occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully. So if that's the case, then the husband must of necessity be out in the world providing for the means and sustenance of the family, right? If you think about it, if the Bible says women are supposed to be keepers at home, then who brings home the bacon? The man, right? Obviously. It's the man's job. Jesus taught, and this is just kind of anecdotal evidence here, but Jesus taught at his second coming that there would be women grinding, like grinding grain, making food, and men would be out in the field. Look at Luke 17:35. Luke 17 and verse 35. He says, "Two women shall be grinding together, the one shall be taken and the other left. Two men shall be in the field, the one shall be taken and the other left." Just kind of showing the pattern here. Women are grinding at home, grinding up the the meal and the grain and that kind of thing, and the men are out there in the field working, bringing it home. The husband of the virtuous woman in Proverbs 31 was known in the gates while his wife was taking care of things at home. Look at Proverbs 31 and verse 23. Proverbs 31, 23. This principle is taught throughout the Bible. It says, her husband is known in the gates when he sitteth among the elders of the land. And then you read about her doing all the things that she's doing at home. And she's clothing her family. She's, rising up and giving them a portion of meat. You know, so she's cooking. She's doing the clothing. She's out there planting a vineyard, you know, taking care of those kind of things. She's making linen, selling it to the merchant, delivering girdles to the merchant. Verse 24, she's doing those kind of things. And her husband is out in the gates. The gates are, in biblical phraseology after Hebrew, whatever that is, for the gates of the city as a place of judicial assembly. So the gates were the place where, like the city hall type of thing, right, where judgment was happening. And so her husband was I don't know if you could call it a political man, but anyway, he was involved in local government here. But he was not at home. He's in the city among the elders, and he's providing, his wife is at home taking care of those things. Now, most women who've not been deceived by the feminist agenda deep down want to be homemakers and be financially supported by their husbands. I truly believe this. I really believe that most women do believe this. They do feel this. I think a lot of women have been deceived by the feminist agenda, though, and they have been deceived into thinking that they need their own career and that they should be out there working. And it's no wonder it's happened, because it happens from birth, pretty much. In this society, after World War II, pretty much from birth on, what have women been told? You know, get yourself an education, go to college, get a career, get yourself established. And then usually it's under the guise of, what happens if something happens to your husband? You need to be able to take care of yourself. I'm not saying it's a fine idea for a woman to have skills to be able to do something if she needed to take care of herself if something happened to her husband. But that's usually what it's taught. It starts in the home, it's in schools, the whole way from elementary school, the whole way up through their education. It's all over TV. It's everywhere. Feminism is everywhere. I mean, think about it. How many people ask their little girls, maybe you've been guilty of this yourself, how many people ask their little girls when they're little, what do you want to be when you grow up, honey? You ever hear Christian parents do that? What do you want to be when you grow up? Asking your little boys, what do you want to be when you grow up? That's a fine question. I'm just curious, why would you ask a question when there is only one answer? Unless you're just testing or something, right? What's the one answer? What do you want to be when you grow up? A wife and a mother. That's what you should want to be, right? But feminism has really taken over, and women have been duped. And many of them, now some women, I think they like to work, right? But many of them don't. And Harley will talk about this, and he has counseled with, you know, hundreds and thousands of women or whatever, and he gets a different story. But many of them don't want to be. They don't want to be out there doing that. They have to be. And you can thank the Federal Reserve and the government for a lot of that, because they have made it not impossible, but difficult to live on one income. Not impossible. My wife and I are examples of this. You can live on one income. You can live on a relatively low income. You can if you want to. Most people would not want to live on the income that I have. I'm not complaining about my income. Don't get me wrong. I'm not complaining at all. I'm just saying most people wouldn't want to live on the income, on one income, if they were me. But we do that for a reason. Here's what Harley said. In truth, a woman does marry a man for his money. At least she wants him to earn enough money to support her as well as, or better than, her father did when she was growing up. And he's right. There's nothing wrong with marrying a man for money. Now, you wouldn't want to marry a man out of covetousness, right? To marry a man for his money, that he can take care of you, that's one thing. To just go out there and find the richest guy you can so that you can live some lavish lifestyle, that's different, right? You don't want to be a gold digger, as they say. I forget that foolish woman. She was some supermodel or something. Anna Nicole Smith, I think, was her name. And she married some guy that was in his 90s, some rich dude in his 90s. And she's 20s or 30s or something. Obviously, she probably wasn't marrying him for love, right? But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about women want to, you know, they want to marry a man that can take care of them. If I was a woman, I would not marry a guy that doesn't have a job, obviously. I don't care how nice you are. I don't care how wonderful of a Christian you are. If you don't have a job, I would never marry you. Period. I wouldn't. And furthermore, if I was a woman, I probably wouldn't get serious in dating a guy that was working at McDonald's or something, right? I would tell him, you know what? I like you a lot, but if you want me, you better get a plan. You better go out and do something, you know, get some kind of a skill. You don't have to go to college or something, but get some kind of a skill, learn something, take an apprenticeship, do something, and get a job that you can provide for the two of us. And let me tell you what, if there's something that will motivate a man to go out there and work hard, it's a girl that he likes. So if I was a girl, that's what I would do. I'd say, we're going to put this relationship on hold until you get established. That's what I would recommend anyway. Here's what Harley says. Whatever women say in public about their willingness to share the burden of making a living, in private I hear something entirely different. Married women tell me they resent working if their working is an absolute necessity. Even part-time work sometimes irritates them if their income has to help pay for basic living expenses. That's what they were telling him. And I can see that. I believe that. Because I think, you know, born into women is that desire to be taken care of. He says, he continues here, page 122, a husband's failure to provide sufficient income for housing, clothing, food, transportation, and the other basics of life commonly cause marital conflict in our society. I think it's a toss-up between money and sex, but those are the two main problems in marriage. Those are the two. And money may even be number one. I'd have to go back and look at the statistics they've done. But anyway, it's definitely a big one. Harley says, I strongly disagree with the materialistic trend that has forced women into the workforce simply to, quote, keep up with the Joneses, not to mention just to keep up with the bank and the credit card bills. Many couples set a standard of living for themselves far higher than they need to be happy. If they would simply reduce their standards of living to a point of comfort, many could avoid husbands working long hours and wives pressured to earn a paycheck. And that's really what it comes down to. It doesn't come usually. I mean, there would be a point in which this isn't true. But typically, it doesn't matter what you make. It matters what you spend, right? People can live on a lot less than they think they need to live on. It's all about what you spend. Because most people, I think, in this country, regardless, and I've read studies like this, it doesn't matter if you make $20,000 a year or you make $100,000 a year. Guess what most people do? They live paycheck to paycheck. They spend all they make. It doesn't matter what they make. And if they made more, they'd spend more. So it is, you got to adjust your standard of living if you want to live on one income. He says if a couple can, quote, bite the bullet, unquote, and lower an unrealistic standard of living, that action frees the husband to set realistic economic objectives regarding the family's basic financial needs. As long as their wives keep working so that together they can finance the big house, big cars, and everyone's credit card habit, where is the incentive to cut back? And that's exactly it, right? As long as you have the money, you're going to keep spending it. So in some ways, the financial situation that we're in with the Federal Reserve debasing the money supply and causing prices to continually rise faster than wages increase, that's a problem. But it's not only that. It's that we have become accustomed to a higher standard of living than we need, right? People talk about in the 1950s, pretty much no women worked in the 1950s, very few. You know, the man worked and they lived off the man's paycheck. But on the other hand, they didn't have two or three cars, right? They didn't have a big, nice, beautiful house. They didn't have a lot of, they didn't have air conditioning. They didn't have them. They didn't even have refrigerators and things like that. Now, granted, as technology progresses, the prices of things come down anyway, so it should be still possible to afford a lot nicer standard of living nowadays because prices should be coming down. But what's happened anyway is that women got suckered into going into the workforce, and now people get used to the two incomes, and now they think they can't live off of less than two incomes. And then it just continues to screw up society because now children are raised by somebody else besides the parents because both are working and so on. And we get into the mess that we have now. People can live on one income if they, most of the time. If you make minimum wage, you probably can't live off of one income. That's impossible. That would be without moving in with your parents or something. That's probably impossible. I'm sure it is. But most people don't make minimum wage. And I would say there's a lot of people out there, and I don't know how many, but I would say there's a lot of people out there that could live on one income if they chose to. But that's what it comes down to. Are you going to choose to do it or not? My wife and I do it because we choose to do it. She could go get a job. She could. I could take her down to the bus barn, and she could do the, not driving. Oh, goodness, no. Well, that'd be, wow. You wouldn't have to worry about it. We wouldn't have any public school system anymore because all the kids would be dead. But anyway, so. No, she could be a monitor down there or something, you know, ride on the bus or whatever. She'd get a job if she wanted to. I wouldn't let her, but if she did, she doesn't want to, but if she did, it'd be possible anyway. Harley says, some well-intentioned people, in the guise of advocating women's rights, encourage all women to develop a career because they see employment as a right and privilege. However, they fail to consider that a woman also has a right and privilege, and I would say duty, to spend time as a homemaker and full-time mother. Those who argue that women do better to choose a career sometimes fail to understand their need as mothers. And I think I mentioned this in the Bible study. A lot of women have been duped. They go to college, they get into the career, they want to get themselves established, and they don't get married until they're in their 30s, and then, or they don't even think about getting married until they're in their 30s. And then guess what? What happens when you're in your 30s? And I know all about it because I got married in my 30s and I wasn't even a woman. I could marry somebody younger. But what happens when you're in your 30s looking, if you're a woman in your 30s and you've chosen, not out of necessity, you've chosen to not get married, and now in your 30s you're looking for a man. And then what kind of a man are you going to find? It's going to be hard, right? Because chances are he's going to already been married, already have kids, right? You're going to have there's going to be a lot of difficulties there, and that's what these women find out. And then their biological clock has been, you know, ticking along, and then it's harder to have children and all that. They've been sold a bill of goods. It's really sad. Now, as a disclaimer, I don't want to pull a Gail Ripplinger here and misquote somebody. I haven't misquoted Harley. I mean, these are complete quotes. But to be fair, he is a proponent of married women having careers if they want them. But he doesn't think, you know, when they're he doesn't think that they should have to, but he's okay if they want to have it. So I disagree with him on that because of what the scripture says, that women are supposed to be keepers at home. So I didn't want you to think that Harley's saying exactly what Pastor Wagner's saying. If you read Harley, he's going to have a more moderate position on it than me, so I just wanted you to know that. Let's see. Do I have enough time? I don't have enough time, but I'll tell you what. There's one more thing that I do want to say, and then we'll pick this up next time. I can't seem to ever get as far along as I want to. I did want to say one thing here, and I just want everybody here to know this. So, you know that this has been one of my soapbox issues, and since I was ordained, I've harped on this, and before I was married, I harped on it, and after I was married, you know, I still believe the same thing, of course, and I believe, you know, women ought to be keepers at home. And then somebody might wonder, but why is your wife tutoring now then? I mean, if they're supposed to be, you always said they're supposed to be keepers at home, why is she tutoring? And this is what I wanted to talk to you about. So, first of all, I have always said that I don't have a problem with women working, doing things per se, and even making money doing things, right? Like the virtuous woman, of course, she made girdles and delivered them to the merchant, right? She made fine linen and sold it. I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with women making things from home, doing some kind of a home-based business or something like that if it didn't take too much time, and making a little money along the way. I've never had an issue with that, and that's essentially what my wife is doing right now. She tutors Koreans and English online for the same people that she used to when she was in the Philippines. And she wanted to do that because she's got the, you know, the motherly instinct. We don't have kids yet. She likes to teach. She wanted, you know, she likes doing that kind of things and helping out kids. And she also tutors adults as well. And so she asked if she could do that. And I said I was okay with that, doing it from home a few hours a day. I was okay with that as long as it wasn't going to affect anything else. And so she's been doing that for a while. And then a couple things. Kind of in the back of my mind, it always bothered me a little bit, I'll be honest with you. And just because I thought, I don't want to appear to be a hypocrite. I don't want anybody to think, oh yeah, you say women should be keepers at home and then your wife's tutoring or whatever. And I don't think anybody probably thought that here, but I didn't want to be viewed as a hypocrite for one thing. That's one thing that I'm really concerned about. And I can tell you that I'm not a hypocrite. And I'll just give you an example of that. Whenever your enemies admit something about you, you can tell it's pretty much true. I had, everybody knows him in Minneapolis, whenever that whole thing was going on with the annihilation thing with Jason, and the night that I met with him, the last night before we had the whole church court thing, and he charged me with heresy, which, by the way, I told him to do, and he would have never done it if I wouldn't have told him that that was the right thing to do. He would have just left like a coward. But anyway, that night, he told me, we were giving each other hugs when we left. It was a weird situation. But anyway, he told me, and I'm not boasting here, but he says, you're a good man. You are not a hypocrite. And boy, have I tried to prove that you were. He, I think for years, early on, very innocently, was probably just watching me. Like, boy, you preach a hard game here. Do you keep it? And that's fine. That's fine. I was being, you know, I'm supposed to be an example. I think probably towards the end, he was probably really trying to find something that he could just say, okay, you're a hypocrite. You say this, but you do something else. And then he could have rejected me. But he told me, you are not a hypocrite. And I was thankful to hear that. So when your enemies tell you something, chances are it's true. So anyway, I tell you, I'm not a hypocrite. And so, but this thing, anyway, with my wife tutoring, it just always, kind of just in the back of my mind, I just thought, I don't want anybody to ever think that I am saying one thing and doing another. Although I'm not. I don't, like I said, I don't have an issue with what she's doing, per se. So anyway, she kind of just started to, the luster of it fell off, and she wasn't all that enthused with it anyway. And then when we would go, like, to see my family in Pennsylvania, or go to see my mother in Florida, or whatever, then she's got to take her computer with her, and she's got to find an internet connection, and she's got to get up early, and she's got to do all this stuff, and it's stressful, and it's a hassle. And so she just decided she doesn't want to do it anymore. And she told her employer there in Korea that she's going to quit in November. And her employer came back and said, if that's the only reason, then don't worry about it. You can just take that time off. You know, I don't care about it. You can have the time off you need. And so then we talked about it, and we both agreed. And I said, you know, I'd just rather you didn't do it. Just because I don't want anybody to ever think that I'm saying one thing and doing another. And so that's what, and she agreed, that's what we decided to do. So she's quitting that in November anyway. So I just wanted to tell you that, just in case you ever wonder, boy, you know, a pastor talks about all this stuff, but then look what his own wife's doing. I just wanted you to know that, because I don't want you to think that I am a hypocrite or something, preaching something that I don't practice myself. So next time, we will pick up with family commitment. And maybe I'm still hoping to get done in two more. So hopefully we can do the family commitment one and then take care of the husband's needs and move on. But I am not going to promise you. It could actually be three more. It's just hard to tell because you know me. I can end up talking a lot once I get up here. I don't talk a lot in private, but once I get up here preaching, I can talk a lot. So anyway, thanks for listening.